One country's role in global agriculture is denoted by one letter. B, for one Iowan, Brazil's gain is his new frontier and challenge.
I get kind of confused because down there I want to have large crops, cheap corn. Up here I want to have somebody have a smaller crop so we can make some money raising corn and soybeans on our own farms.
Hello, I'm Paul Yeager, and this is the MTOM. Welcome. Bruce Rastetter calls himself an agricultural entrepreneur. He was even under consideration for head of the USDA following Donald Trump's election. Agriculture is his first love, but sporting events still get the blood pumping.
Which, for you, is more exciting? To walk in 10 minutes before tip-off at a basketball game or 10 minutes before kickoff at a football game? You're a big sports
guy. I think probably kickoff before the Iowa-Ohio State game last fall was the best walk-in that we've been able to do. Actually, the first couple of seconds on the interception.
When you walk into an event, I mean, do you still get excited? Well, I mean, you've been to, I would imagine, hundreds of sporting events over time. Are they still fun
for you? Yeah, they are. There's something about the crowd, the excitement, the day, just the whole atmosphere. And then certainly not knowing how it's going to come out, how the team's going to play. I can only imagine being a coach and doing that.
Now, as a Hawkeye guy, more, but when your time with the Iowa Board of Regents, did you go to Iowa State and UNI and experience some of those athletic
contests?
Yeah,
sure I did. I went to the games there, but, whenever the Iowa-Iowa State game happened and I had black and gold on, they'd all say, don't you have to be neutral? And it's like, no, I don't have to be neutral. They all know that I graduated from Iowa Hawkeye fan. I close ties to Iowa State on agriculture, the College of Ag, and obviously at the Regents, all three schools.
Sure.
And trying to do what was right.
So in your career, what's more exciting now with your business venture? Is it more fun to walk into a plant that's just opened or go back to a hog barn or into a hay? I mean, what one of those compares to walking into a sporting event for you?
Yeah, for us and one of our key guys, Justin, that heads our Brazil investment, I were down in Brazil a couple of weeks ago, and we drove away from the plant. And it's the first modern corn ethanol plant in Brazil, producing 62 million gallons. Really terrific job. Came out of the ground on time. And drove away and couldn't help but say, gee, think what a couple of Iowa farm kids can do. And it's really a great feeling to build something in a positive way in an industry that's growing. I think there's not a feeling quite like it. And then also to hire good people, see them grow, all the challenges, all the headaches with managing people, growing a business, all the components with it. But, yeah, I think it's building. And more recently, it's been building that. I had the same feeling when we built our first corn ethanol plant in Iowa Falls.
And that was what year?
That year was 2005. The plant, 2004. The plant opened in 2005. And then we raised the money to double it and build a plant in Fairbank, Iowa, 110-million-gallon plant that opened in the spring of 2006.
How different do you feel the ethanol industry is from 2005, 4, 5, and 6 than it is to 17, 18, and maybe what comes in 19?
Yeah, I think the really great part about being involved in the industry in 2004 to kind of 2008 timeframe was the rapid growth of the industry, the opportunity. We obviously got hit with high-priced corn with the droughts and the challenges with that. And you had an increasing demand in the marketplace that would happen. And suddenly you have the RFS, hit the blend wall. You had 10% blending become, saturated. And then the inability and the slowness of the ability to grow that to 15% has created some real challenges. Obviously, farmers responded, raised a lot of corn. We had corn go from $7 to $3, and it's come back a little bit. But, clearly it's an exciting time in the industry and a much different time now with margins constricted. Brazil feels a lot like early times of the U.S. ethanol industry.
Was it the Wild West at that point here in the States, or did you still feel it was pretty regulated enough and there was still lots of guidance and where the government wanted you to go?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of guidance. I think the issue for the ethanol industry and for agriculture in general is not the ability to produce, because clearly investment capital flowed into the ethanol industry as it did into high-priced grain, resulted in new investment both in the land, technology, equipment, and then the ability to produce more. What what is challenging, I think, is the ability to predict the marketplace and the ability to grow that when you don't control the pump. And so, you know, every car in Brazil can burn 100% ethanol. 80% of the cars in the U.S. can burn 15%, and yet we don't have 15% pumps everywhere, and so you don't have consumer choice. So in order to see this industry flourish and see agriculture continue to take opportunity at growth, we're going to have to see increased markets.
What's holding back domestically in the United States? I mean, companies like yours, not necessarily yours, but companies who have ethanol plants, they've put out their own pumps to allow consumers that choice. But how do you get past into those major retailers in the country, to especially outside of the Midwest, to tell them, hey, this is important and we think your customer is going to want that?
Yeah, I think, and as you know, we sold our ethanol company in the U.S. in 2011, but I still try to stay active in public policy, and I think it's really important. We raise corn, soybeans, and also want to see agriculture be successful. I think what you have to do, and clearly the challenge is that oil companies control the pump. And so there's been a variety of programs to have blender pumps, to have E15, E10, E85, but not enough stations are doing it. And so consumers, you can't buy E15 everywhere. And so I think those programs need to be expanded, but you have to have the government ensure that you have access to the marketplace if you're an ethanol producer, because otherwise the oil companies will just refine oil. And that, you know, at the end of the day, that's what it's about. A gallon of energy can be produced extremely cheap today from corn prices where they're at, very competitive against oil, down to $25, $30 a barrel competitive-wise. And sustainability is obviously much better with ethanol than it is with oil.
Has that argument changed, though, since we've been able to have the shale exploration and, say, the Bakken, or understanding how to unlock other oil out of Texas, out of Permian before?
I think that, yeah, that's clearly why you had oil go down to $30 a barrel, but it's now back up to in the mid-60s or low 60s. So, but also at the same time that they've gotten more efficient, corn production, ethanol production has. So instead of 140 or 170 bushel yields, you know, last year in our farm, we had 226 bushel yields. That's happened, obviously, across the state, which is why we're producing this mountain of corn. The ethanol plants have also gotten more efficient. So they're, you know, 2.85 gallons of ethanol per bushel of corn, higher than it was before. The sustainability factor of reuse of water, the continued march towards efficiency in that industry has led to a lower cost on a BTU unit and less carbon creation by each gallon of ethanol produced.
You don't sound like somebody who sold a plant in 2011 in the United States.
Well, you know, the nice part is being able to continue to work with all those guys that are doing great work in Washington, being able to talk to Secretary Perdue and encourage him on the recent discussion with the EPA as to what should happen with year-round blending, what we need to do on the RENS number. And, you know, there's some good work being done there, and it's really important for agriculture.
How close are we to a Secretary Rastetter?
You know, I like being part of the process, not being the guy that's doing the process. So, you know, we'll continue to be involved, but always looking for opportunities to make an impact.
We can go into Secretary Perdue a little bit more. I want to know more about this Brazil operation that you have. Why? When did you start eyeing that as something that you felt that your company or you and your business interests should explore?
Yeah, I think being involved in ag my whole life, it's you know, not unlike others, when you look at the world, two countries in the world are going to produce the majority of the world's food. The U.S. will continue to have incremental increases, but Brazil is the country in the world that has the ability to dramatically increase. They have the land availability. They have the ability to double crop now with biotechnology, and they have the ability to double crop without irrigation. And they have been readily for decades accepting U.S. technology, U.S. companies. Everybody that we deal with in Iowa Falls, Iowa, is in Brazil. So we had felt with biotechnology, we traveled there after sold Heartland, or Hawkeye, I mean, and traveled to Brazil, spent a lot of time there trying to figure out what made sense. Took with us ICM that built our U.S. ethanol plants, and found a partner in North Central Mato Grosso that owned a biodiesel plant, a company called Fiagril that was very active in the ag space that fit with our views. So raised the capital, built their first modern corn ethanol plant.
How many plants are there like yours in Brazil?
You know, Brazil produces about 7 billion gallons of ethanol, almost all of it from sugarcane ethanol. And there's a couple of smaller 10, 20 million gallon corn ethanol plants, but this is the first modern one. We think there'll be more. We plan on building more, but certainly their ability to produce corn just dramatically continues to increase. So it's good for them to use it there rather than exporting on the world market.
Because it allows for U.S. farmers to producers to have somewhere to go with their grain. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think you know, the world clearly is becoming very fungible on grain. When you look at the amount of soybeans we provide to China, you know, 61% of Brazil's crop goes to export, majority of it to China and the European Union. So as they continue to increase production, you know, I think it's really important that they, and they know this because of the cost of getting grain out of the country, that they embrace value added. So biodiesel, corn ethanol, further processing of soybean meal. Their livestock herds are increasing, both hogs, chicken, cattle, now going into feedlots because they produce corn. So I think all that will help supplement what the world's going to need. And you will continue to have, as we've seen in this market with the effect of Argentina and their drought, a dramatic change in grain prices over the last couple months as that's happened. Brazil is the same way. If they don't get it planted on time, U.S. Everything is priced off the CBOT. So the two continents are going to be the leaders going forward.
When was your first trip to Brazil?
First trip to Brazil actually was in 2011, and made about a dozen trips until we figured out where we should locate, what we wanted to do there.
So when you went in 11, that's you had never been there before, and just thought this is an opportunity?
Yeah, I'd never been there before, and yet talked to a lot of people that had, and clearly wanted to, had always had responsibility for the hog company and the ethanol company, got freed up from that and thought, you know, want to travel there, want to learn more about it. And so we did that, took the time to travel throughout the country, see a big chunk of their agriculture, and also talked to U.S. companies that had invested down there, what went wrong. And so we just spent quite a bit of time. And then decided to form the funds that we have to buy both farmland there as well as then build this corn ethanol plant.
So you've been down there more than a dozen times then?
Yeah,
since
so
then,
now
probably?
Since we started building the plant, have been going down there once a month.
Yeah.
So I go down there about a dozen times a year, spend the week. We're going next Monday again. You know, it's just amazing how the growth of their agriculture, how same tractor that I was – we got a new used tractor today on a high-speed John Deere planter, so I stand by that today, and they have the exact same equipment in Brazil.
Right, because John Deere has a big setup down there.
So it's really interesting to see that as you travel, and they've got corn tasseling down there, and they've got corn they're just planting. So we hopefully have a good corn crop to produce a little ethanol.
So you're one of those guys that has to sit there. You know, some producers in this country, I won't say hope for bad weather down there, but they hope that the crop isn't as big to allow, you know, a rally in Chicago to help them. And here you are. And the thing is you're not the only one that has operations in both countries anymore.
Yeah, I think probably where you're headed at is I get kind of confused because down there I want to have large crops, cheap corn. Up here I want to have somebody have a smaller crop so we can make some money raising corn and soybeans on our own farm. So, yeah, I get confused as to how I think about that.
You'd look at the marketing advice and go, okay, now wait a minute. Is that for this one or this one? Do you have to hire a different ag marketing person to look at you.
You know, the really neat part and one of the neat things for me in my life is just the network that Ben associated with. So whether it's a guy like Harry Stein that I can talk to about corn seed genetics, or McBain in Tennessee that's a commodity group that worked with a long time, that talked to them about what's going on in South America, Argentina, what's happening in wheat, which has kind of driven the market as of late, and to what's happening in oil, ethanol production. So just try to talk to some smart people, and you know, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen, but staying in tune so you can at least not panic when you think corn's going to go way up and hold them up on buying corn. But also, hopefully, we're smarter sellers of corn when we go to do it ourselves.
Do you find value in this work? Click over to iptv.org to show your support of our efforts. Now back to Bruce Rastetter.
With Brazil in their setup of sugar-based ethanol, corn is something that's still a new concept for them, is what I'm gathering what you're saying. And how do you see that it'll be those inside the country that expand corn, or will it be folks like you that come in and see the benefits of ethanol and say, here's an opportunity.
In terms
for us.
Of expansion, I think it'll be both. It'll be outside companies like ourselves, and it'll be individuals within Brazil, whether it's large co-ops or farmers that group together or ag businesses they have down there. Interesting number for you, Paul. 10 years ago, Mato Grosso, mm-hmm. which is kind of the Iowa of Brazil, but it's one and a third the size of Texas. 10 years ago, it produced 250 million bushel of corn. Last year, it produced 1.2 billion bushel of corn.
Oh,
we think within the next decade, it will produce 4 to 5 billion bushel of corn. Today, they produce 1.2. Iowa produced 2.7. We're the first modern corn ethanol plant in Mato Grosso. Iowa has 42 of them, most of which are twice as big as what we built in Brazil. So their opportunity to double their ethanol production, which the government has stated that they want to do, is going to come from corn ethanol. Sugarcane takes a lot of land, isn't as efficient a process as corn ethanol in Brazil. So we think it'll happen through corn.
Well, you remember, I would imagine, the argument against ethanol early on, corn-based ethanol in the United States, was, oh, you're taking land out of here or here or here to put it to corn to use to ethanol. Is that discussion going on in Brazil now with you're taking land out of either forest or whatever, or even out of sugarcane, and making it into corn?
Yeah, I mean, when you drive past fields, and I first found that argument kind of interesting when I went to Brazil and hadn't been there in 2011. When you drive past the sugarcane field, gee, guess what? Across the road, there is soybeans being produced, which means on that sugarcane land, you could have produced soybeans. So that food versus fuel debate, as we know, has been a myth from the very beginning and a rumor perpetuated by oil companies. So when you think about Brazil and their ability to be sustainable, first of all, you know, they aren't clearing the Amazon. Closer to the Amazon you get, the more percentage of the ground you have to leave in trees. So it goes from 80% planted in southern Brazil to 80% trees the further north you go, and 20% tillable. So they do that. It's mainly pasture ground that had been cleared. And now with double cropping, you know, they have the ability to double crop without irrigation because of biotechnology shortening those days from planting to harvest. So that has continued to give them more opportunity to produce more corn each year and soybean yields similar to what we have in Iowa.
Are they doing it mostly on just better technology on growing this corn? I mean, when you talk about, you know, the tripling or quadrupling these this bushel production, is it mostly on the seed? Is it just their better understanding of corn? How is this growth really happening?
Yeah, for me, and as I mentioned, hopefully you surround yourself with enough smart guys and then you have a simple approach to things. And I can remember the first trip Western Mato Grosso, and we're standing in a soybean field that's being harvested, and ask the farmer, what are the number of days soybeans that you plant? And these soybeans were 102 days soybeans. And I said, what was it when you first started farming this, which is like 10 years before? He said it was 120 days soybeans. So they're actually doing some 90, 92 day soybeans now. So they plant, which means then that they've shaved 20 days off off planting to harvest on soybeans. They're planting 108, 110-day corn. They used to plant 125-day corn, so they shaved 20 days off of that. So they've taken 40 days out of the growing season for two crops, which means if they plant in September and October, harvest in January, February, the soybeans, they're planting corn the next day. Mm-hmm. You know, you see combines running in the same field that planters are behind them, planting corn or cotton, and then they're harvesting that corn in May and June before the rains quit. And it's really biotechnology shortening the days that's allowed them to take advantage of the rainy season to do that, and also improved varieties that now are grown there with the genetic populations. But you have Monsanto, Pioneer, Syngenta, everybody's down there.
Well, they've done well in the United States, and it's no different than what they've done in Brazil. They've studied the land. They've figured out the calendars like you're talking about. That's very interesting. Do you think in this country, in the United States, that we would ever – granted, where you're from, where you farm, you're not going to be able – the only thing that goes in after your combine is maybe something doing cover crop or something like that. We just can't compete that way. So how are we going to compete in the United States with Brazil?
Yeah, I think how we're going to compete is to continue to drive things with technology and our ability to accept it and improve on that. So, you know, for instance, the yield number that I mentioned, you know, we will have yields continue to increase 2 to 5% every year. So I think it's being innovative, going to narrower rows. So we're going from 30-inch rows to 20-inch rows this year, higher populations, so going to 44, 45,000 plants per acre instead of 37,000 plants. And so continuing to do that, continuing to make maximum use of fertilizer, so multiple applications of nitrogen, you know, soil mapping, improvement of the land, whether it's with tile, whether it's with the nutrient application, the cover crops, so that we can not have that runoff during the winter, in particular sequestering the nitrogen with it. And there's a lot of work to be done there, both from water quality and otherwise. But I think how we do it is then we use all that grain we produce, or as much of it, here and add value to it rather than ship it out as a commodity. And then I think, too, when you look around the state, The investment in the infrastructure is really critical. So the infrastructure bill that Trump's talked about, I know Governor Branstad had proposed, we need new locks and dams on the Mississippi River. You know, Brazil is doing that. When you go there, they're building roads to where they load in the barge and they can ship without locks and dams all the way to the mouth of the Amazon and shortcut their way through the Panama Canal to China. So we have to invest in both the infrastructure and we have to be accepting of new infrastructure in terms of protein production, of hogs, cattle, chickens, and then also we need higher ethanol blends, and you'll see continue to see a robust U.S. agriculture. But we have to have those investments to stay competitive. We built a railroad a long time ago, but we better have new locks and dams. We better have the rest of things that help this country be competitive.
Who's doing the investing on these locks and dams in Brazil? Is that a government thing?
You know, it's a government thing on the roads. But, you know, once they get to the river, they don't – on most of the rivers, they don't need locks and dams.
If they don't have the locks and dams that you're talking about, so you don't have to have it.
It's just getting it to the river. But then in particular, with their increase in production, you know, they long-term will need railroads, which has been difficult for them to get built and to be able to do – that. So we have time and we have the ability to do that, but we don't have the ability to do it if we just sit on the sidelines and don't make investments in those things.
In the United States, should fund more of this lock and dam renovation? Is that more of a government thing, or should that be more of a the ADMs and those types of companies that are going to benefit?
Yeah, I think the great news is that the government has invested in that infrastructure, whether it's the interstate highway system where you have a tax on gasoline and diesel fuel, or the locks and dams, and so that it's open to competitive processes rather than an ADM or a Cargill just making that infrastructure and being able to do that. So I think it's no different than making sure we have multiple choices on railroads or multiple choices on markets. So if you don't like the bid at the local co-op to ship the grain out in a unit train, you can send it to an ethanol plant or you can sell it to a feed mill. And a choice of markets is going to be really critical.
I remember the growers, my father and the guy that has since taken over his farm. Fairbank was a place when that went online. That was somewhere they could go, and that was a better deal for them. So, of course, that's where they went. So that competition helped in Buchanan County, Iowa, just like it did in other places. I think you said 54 different ethanol plants that you have.
Yeah, and I think when we built the Owl Falls plant and doubled it, Hardin County produced about 47 million bushel of grain, and that plant uses 50 million bushel of corn. So you're actually importing
you have to
corn
bring it
into
from somewhere.
The county, and that's what's been great about the 42 plants in Iowa and the investment in that infrastructure that the state supported through some tax credits, communities supported. You've seen the DOT, you know, it obviously changes grain flow, so there needs to be different roads, turning lanes to make it safe. And then I think the investment also in some of the railroads to make sure that you can ship that ethanol out of Iowa to the coast and be competitive. And, you know, there's a significant amount of Iowa ethanol being exported today. So shipped to Houston, put on a ship. Brazil imports 500 million gallons of U.S. ethanol. So we'll continue to supply a lot of it around the world, and that should be a good thing.
Secretary Perdue, what is his biggest challenge that he faces in rural America right now, you think, in his next 3 years?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. I think it's balancing making sure we don't lose any ethanol consumption at a time of low grain prices, because clearly ethanol is a marginal user of corn, and without it, you know, we'd have a real farm crisis going on. So I think maintaining that near term and finding the ability to grow it, and then I think making sure that the world is available for U.S. ag products. As we export a significant amount of soybeans and corn, pork, all the increase in pork production will have to be exported, and around 25% of it is today. As I mentioned on ethanol, a significant amount of it, as they go over 15 billion gallons, is exported. So there are also a number of countries that have tariffs against U.S. beef, tariffs on soybeans going to European Union. You know, when everyone gets concerned about NAFTA and what Trump is doing there, when you look around the world and you see that the European Union doesn't allow U.S. soybeans there freely, distillers grain, we had a tariff that China put on a year ago. Mm-hmm. There was a 50% tariff, and they arbitrarily did that. So there's not a clean solution to it, but if you don't fight back, you're not going to change that and allow easy access to U.S. products around the world, because we can compete if we have access.
Fight back how? Go with more of the tariffs?
Yeah, I think you have to point out to them that if they're going to have tariffs on products that come into their country, we're probably going to have some that come into here. And if we want free trade, it has to be fair. So while Japan may expect the U.S. to accept Japanese cars tariff-free, we know that there's still 16 years left on the beef tariffs in Japan that prohibit essentially U.S. beef from going there. Same thing on South Korea. So, you know, those countries need to be more open if they expect their products to flow free in the U.S. And the challenge with this is somebody gets hurt each time each country puts a tariff in place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but at the same standpoint, just because your industry doesn't get hurt on soybeans going to China, it also isn't good to see when we all live in rural communities the destruction of manufacturing jobs because of issues around NAFTA. So I think it is going to become a balancing act. It's an issue the country should have faced years ago. It's going to have to face now, and hopefully there's not too much pain in specific sectors in ag today that get hurt by it.
I've asked our market analysts when they've come in, I said, who wins if we tear up NAFTA or greatly renegotiated? Who do you think wins?
Yeah, I think if you renegotiate it, I think rural communities win. And same time, I think Trump recognized in the last 2 weeks in exempting Canada and Mexico from the steel tariffs that they're critically important to U.S. ag products, and in particular Mexico and Canada. So I think there's a balancing act, but I think sending the message that, you know, let's open up these tariffs. You know, I know of a radiator company in Washington, Iowa that moved to a tax-free zone in Nogales. and you had 250 high-quality jobs lost in Washington. And those jobs are hard to replace, and in rural communities. So there's got to be a balance with it, and agriculture has really benefited from trade. But some of our rural communities have been decimated by those practices.
So you're saying rural communities, but not agriculture. Agriculture could lose.
Agriculture could lose, but also agriculture could benefit. You know, if China isn't slapping tariffs on distillers grain, that's an important export product for Iowa. If you take away South Korea and Japan's tariffs on beef, you know, we win on that too. So I think that there just needs to be a look at what individual countries are going to, because sometimes we get lost in the whole mix of what's happening in different segments as it changes. I'll give you an example. Brazil decided last September to put a 20% tariff on U.S. ethanol coming there.
That's right.
Well, more recently, Brazil is exporting beef to the U.S. tariff-free. So, you know, I really have mixed emotions about that in our business. But if you're an American looking at that, you're saying, we're allowing them to tariff our ethanol, but we're letting their beef into this country free. So I think there needs to be a more 30,000-foot look when these trade negotiators do that. And I have a good friend that had a cargo ship going to China when they put a 50% tariff on DDGs when he had a 5% margin in it. And I heard a U.S. trade negotiator say, well, we'll win in court when we sue China over that in whatever court they sue in, right? And it's like, well, if you're in business and you're talking to your banker, I don't think the banker is going to wait till, you know, some negotiator decides he can win. Yeah. So it needs to be dealt with aggressively when it happens. And it needs to be dealt with at the highest level, or else you're just open to the vagrancies of those countries doing something when you happen to have a ship going that way.
You could say that some would say the negotiating ploy wasn't really a ploy. It was more of we were being taken advantage of when we allow the Brazilian beef to come in tariff-free.
Yeah.
That was a good faith. Some would see it as good faith, but in the others, it's like, no, we're getting tariffed here, so therefore –
And I think those discussions, and it looks like between the U.S. and Brazil, it's happened logically, that, gosh, if you want beef to come here, don't be tariffing our ethanol. So we see signs that they're going to lift that tariff and do that, because the country needs a lot of ethanol. There's still been all the U.S. ethanol going there, because Brazil is a competitive market, and the U.S. can export ethanol to Brazil.
When you introduce yourself to people or people introduce you, how do they introduce you? Like, this is Bruce Rastetter. He's, what words do they use now to describe you?
What's been really good lately, not being president of the region, so Des Moines Register doesn't get to introduce me as the way that they sometimes do. But I think, you know, how people introduce me as an ag entrepreneur and an Iowan, you know, who cares about the state, and someone who wants to grow and develop businesses.
And that has been, is this it for Bruce Rastetter? I mean, you always get asked. I mean, I've already asked you about USDA head. You're not running for that or put your name in for that. And a governor gets thrown around. Ag entrepreneur going to do it for you? You've got a pretty good drive.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I think you always want to make a difference in life. So, you know, the next chapter is always the next chapter. And that's what's really neat about meeting enough people, doing things, and trying to do business the right way. So I'd like to think we've got a lot of great projects at hand. We're going to continue to do that. And we'll just see what happens. I enjoyed my time as president of the region for most part. And we felt like we accomplished things and froze tuition for 2.5 years. And access and public universities is critical in this state. So and also got increased funding. So, you know, if something happens along the way that's different than I'm doing now, we'll just evaluate it then. And that's the answer I give everybody, because I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I believe if you really work hard at doing business, and we tell our young people that work for us this every day with great people that you can trust that have integrity, you know, you can accomplish good things. And the market's the market, but you can accomplish a lot more with great people.
When people meet you from, say, Brazil, and you say Iowa, do they know where you're from?
Yeah, they all know Iowa. And, you know, most of them have been here. It traveled here. Our partner in our ethanol plant had been through an ethanol plant in Iowa. And that's why he was excited about meeting someone who wanted to build it with him, because he knows that it would work there and do well. So they know Iowa. It's, you know, they'd like to become the Iowa to the world, like Iowa has been in agriculture production. And so I think that's our challenge. But it's also the opportunity with education, with the cultivation corridor, with the innovation, to export a lot of technology that's developed here and Iowans make money on and helps our economy by going there. So when you go up and down the streets there, you see Case, IH, you see John Deere, ADM, Cargill, Bunge. All the technology that we use here is being exported to Brazil. And so there's a great opportunity for U.S. agriculture to benefit from that.
I got one final topic I just want to broach. As a guy who lives in Hardin County, Iowa, not a huge area where college grads from Regent or whatever, wherever they're at, they're not necessarily looking to move to your county. Why is it, or how is it, counties like yours will attract, or what can they do to attract some of those graduates and help build maybe a different type of economic growth or get back to what we had 40, 50 years ago? How is it in rural Iowa we improve lives, if that's something you're interested in?
One of the things that, you know, it's a real challenge, and we see it in our business, is attracting people, in particular with the growth in Des Moines and Ames, and where they've really, near us, have become really great cities to live in, and you've had some decline in rural Iowa. So I think one of the ways you can do that is, you know, a new hospital, and Iowa Falls has that. Having additional businesses that go there that have higher paying jobs. You know, we've located our office out in the country west of Alden so that if someone wants to live on the north side of Ames, Story City, they can do that and still have a short commute. But I think it's making sure that the school systems are good and improving, and that they have the same access to quality schools there as they do in Des Moines, so that they want to live there with their family and participate and grow. But it is a real challenge, because typically the spouse wants to have employment in an area that he or she is involved in if you employ the other one. And so there isn't always that opportunity there. But what I think you have to focus on is the company, the investment, the ability for rural Iowa to be open to both manufacturing and agriculture, or we won't have vibrant communities there.
We have to have – where's the entrepreneurial spirit fit into that? Or at least it's not one of those skills you can teach. I don't know how you came across your drive to be an entrepreneur, but, I mean, how do you instill that or teach that in a school?
Yeah, I don't know that either, and I think that's one of the challenges that you have in education. But one of the things that I wanted to help fund was the Ag Entrepreneurship Program at Iowa State that had endowed a chair there that, as they were starting that program – that's really grown and is now going across the university in terms of entrepreneurship between the business school, engineering, agriculture, you know, veterinarians taking classes so that they can better manage their businesses when they graduate. And I think if all it accomplishes is teaches people more how the system works, you know, financial responsibility, the diversity of that, it will make them better employees for companies that they work for. But also, I think in today's world, more companies are becoming entrepreneurial. You know, kids are smarter than they come out of when they come out of college than a bunch of us were. And so they're ahead on that. And I think if you create an environment where they can be part of the process in a transparent way, you'll create more entrepreneurs. As there's nothing that I think feels better than seeing people grow within your company and take responsibility and do well. And being able to do that in a more open work environment, the way the work environment goes today, you know, is one of the challenges. But I think certainly in our world has worked out pretty well.
All right. Bruce Rastetter, thank you so very much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
My thanks to you for taking time to find us and make M2M a part of your day. Please consider giving us a 5-star review to help others find us. I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening.